I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse.
You're listening to episode 632 of Unwelcome Guests, The War on Kids. I'm Robin Upton. Regular listeners will be familiar with a lot of environmental problems, biological, radiological pollution, depletion of natural resources. In a lot of physical ways, the Earth is not what it was. But this week we're going to be looking at perhaps an even more toxic legacy of the capitalist competitive system, the minds and the brains of our children, the ever more desperate efforts to adjust healthy children to fit into a sick and dying society. We have three pieces for you this week. But begin with, let's hear Dimitri Christakis. This is a TEDx talk on the relationship between exposure to media and the development of young children.
I am a pediatrician, a researcher, and a parent. And I became those things in that order. And the reason the sequencing is important is because even though I was a doctor who took care of children for a while, and I was a researcher who studied ways to keep them healthy, it wasn't until I became a parent that I got interested in, some might even say obsessed with, early learning. It was 14 years ago when my son was born, and I took a month paternity leave to be with him in his third month of life. And now in retrospect, as a pediatrician, I should have known better because I opted for the time when colic crescendos. And I spent that month with him in a snuggly, bouncing on a big blue ball and watching more daytime television than I have in my life, and noticed that he was actually interested in it. And as much as I like to believe that my two-month-old was following CNN as closely as I was, it was obvious to me that he wasn't, and yet something about that experience was important to him. Now, why do these early experiences matter? The typical newborn brain is 333 grams. And in the first 2 years of life, it actually triples in size. It's an extraordinary period of brain growth, unparalleled over the life course. And you can see that here. Here is both brain growth over the lifespan, and you can see how steep the rise is early on. And it continues to grow until about age 20, and I'll let you guys in the audience find yourselves over on the right there and see why you had such a hard time finding your car keys this morning. Now, we're actually born with a lifetime supply of brain cells or neurons. That's not what actually grows. It's the connections between those brain cells, what we call synapses, that account for that brain growth. And those synapses form based on early experiences. If you will, the mind is fine-tuned to the world that babies inhabit. And to give you an example of that you can all relate to, any child born anywhere in the world can learn to speak any language fluently. But if she isn't exposed to certain sounds early in the first few years of her life, she can learn to speak another language later, but she'll never sound like a native speaker. So a baby born today in mainland China, as amazing as it is, can learn to speak fluent Mandarin. But if she doesn't hear English sounds early in her life, she can learn to speak English later. But as we all know, we know such people, she'll struggle making certain sounds. It wasn't because she wasn't born with that capacity. It was because her early experience didn't condition her mind to learn them. Now, this graphic actually shows just that. What you see is the brain, and you see the neurons and the synapses connecting them. We're born with about 2,500 synapses. By age 3, we have 15,000. And then over time, those connections are actually pruned in response to the external stimulation, the external world that we live in. To give you another example of that, this is the breathing pattern of a one-day-old infant listening to music. And you can see here that he's listening to Mozart, and then Stravinsky is put on, and then Mozart again. Now, I show you this not to present some kind of an infantile critique of classical music, but and those of you in the audience who are classic music aficionados might have a hypothesis about why Stravinsky did this to his breathing pattern. But the point is that even at 1 day of life, there's a discernible physiological reaction to what babies are actually hearing. Now, we know from decades of research that too little stimulation early on is bad for brain development. I show you here two PET scans. Now, PET scans are measures of brain function. The brighter colors show more brain activity. And on the left is a PET scan of a normal kindergartner. And on the right is a PET scan of a child who was raised in a horribly neglected environment. This is actually a PET scan from a child who was raised in a Romanian orphanage and was profoundly neglected early in life. And you'll notice that there are areas of his brain that show no activity at all. It didn't develop as a result of too little stimulation. Now, this is a horrific example of too little stimulation and the untoward consequences of it. But the question we've had in our lab for some time is, what about too much? Is it actually possible to overstimulate the developing brain, or more appropriately, to inappropriately stimulate the developing brain in ways that are actually not beneficial, but harmful? And this is important because we're technologizing childhood today in a way that's unprecedented. In 1970, the average age at which children began to watch television regularly was 4 years. And today, based on research that we've done, it's 4 months. It's not just how early they watch, but how much they watch. The typical child before the age of 5 is watching about 4.5 hours of TV a day. That represents as much as 40% of their waking hours. Which brings us to Baby Einstein. Now, many of you probably have not seen Baby Einstein, but I will show you a random 20-second clip from Baby Einstein Day on the Farm, and here it is. In that 20-second clip, there were 7 scene changes, about 1 every 3 seconds. It's about the most exhausting day on the farm since John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath. And of course, it's nothing like being on a real farm, right? Adults watching this find it discombobulating because your mind is trying to make a coherent narrative out of this, and there is no coherent narrative. It jumps all over the place. But babies aren't trying to make a coherent narrative out of it. They're not capable of doing that. It's all of that screen change, all of that stimulation that's keeping them actually engaged in the screen. So we've had for a while what we call the overstimulation hypothesis, which is that prolonged exposure to this rapid image change during this critical window of brain development would precondition the mind to expect high levels of input, and that would lead to inattention in later life. So you watch enough Baby Einstein Day on the Farm as a baby, and when you go to a farm as a school-aged child, it's boring. It's too slow. How come there's no sheep suddenly popping into my face? How come there's no marionette going back and forth? Why do I have to walk from here to there? That's the general idea, that you're conditioning the mind to that reality, which doesn't actually exist. We tested this some years ago, and what we found was that the more television children watched before age 3, the more likely they were to actually have attentional problems at school age. Specifically, for each hour that they watched before the age of 3, their chances of having attentional problems was increased by about 10%. So a child who watched 2 hours of TV a day before the age of 3 would be 20% more likely to have attention problems compared to a child who watched none. Now, what else did we find? We found that the more cognitive stimulation children received, and we measured cognitive stimulation in terms of how often parents read to their child, how often they took them to the museum, how often they sang to them, we found that cognitive stimulation reduced the chances of attentional problems later in life. In fact, each hour of cognitive stimulation reduced them by about 30%. So if you will, these are two sides of the same coin. There are certain things that we can do early on in our children's lives that enhance their ability to pay attention, and certain things that we can do early on that actually impede them. Now, if our hypothesis was right, that it's based on the pacing of the programs, then you might imagine that what children watch actually is important. And so content would be key. And I'll give you 2 examples of content to illustrate that point. The first is the Powerpuff Girls movie, the right mix of sugar and spice for a satisfying rush. I don't know how many of you have seen that, but here is a scene from that. It's a again, you can see a lot of rapid sequencing. In fact, this was the first movie that was ever rated PG for nonstop frenetic animated action. I'm not making it up. That's the back of the box there. Now, I want to contrast that with something that I'm sure you're all very familiar with. It really needs no introduction, but this is a clip from Mr. Rogers for you to watch.
Hi, Odd.
Oh, hi, Grant. I'm fine. How are you?
Good, thanks. I brought my television neighbor to see what a restaurant was like.
Oh, I'm so glad. Can I show you a table?
Certainly.
I'm awfully busy today. One of the waitresses is ill.
I see.
So I'm sort of doing double duty. How about this?
This is fine. Thank
Grant,
you very much.
Sit down and I'll be right back.
All right. Now, when you come to a restaurant, usually somebody shows you what table you're supposed to sit at. And one of the first things you do is to put your napkin either on your lap or up here. And then, well, this is the way a table is set.
Fred Rogers invented reality TV. He's not credited with it. Actually, it's not reality, right? It's even slower paced than reality. The waitress says, "I'm awfully busy," but she doesn't seem the least bit hurried. So you can see that there are very, very real differences in pacing. And when we followed up our study with a subsequent experiment to look at what children actually watch, what you see is that educational programs like Mr. Rogers pose no increased risk of attentional problems. Entertainment programs like the Powerpuff Girls movie increase the chances by about 60%. And violent programming, which I didn't show you, increases it even by more than 100%. And violent programs are typically even more rapidly sequenced. Now, in the last year, we've been building actually a mouse model of television viewing in my lab. And you are now watching Mouse TV here. The sounds are from the Cartoon Network, and the lights are basically photorhythmically generated by those sounds. This is what it looks like. These are the TV lounges here that the mice live in. And they have speakers above and lights around them. And what we do is we start about 10 days of life, and these mice watch TV 6 hours a day for 42 days. It's basically their entire childhood spent in front of a television, which is not uncommon these days for some children even. And then 10 days later, we actually assess their behavior in a few ways I want to show with you. The first test we do measures their activity and risk-taking. Now, we do what's called the open field test. Now, mice have two kind of competing instincts. You'll see them here. One is to avoid being in the middle of anything, because, of course, mice have very few friends, and being in the middle of this open field is risky. But, of course, they have a competing instinct to forage for food, so at some point they do need to go into the middle and explore their environment. Now, we put these mice in here and test them, and we exploit the fact that it's a white mouse on a black background. And with a computer above, we can actually track their movement. And you can see on the left is sort of a normal mouse spending most of its time around the perimeter. But look at the one on the right. Notice how much time it spends in the middle, but also notice just how much general activity this mouse is actually exhibiting. So this is both a hyperactive and a risk-taking mouse. And when we look at our overstimulated compared to our control mice, we find that the overstimulated mice spend more time in the center, and they enter the center more than the regular mice do. The next test we do is what's called the novel object recognition, and this tests short-term memory and learning. We put a mouse in a box with two objects, and the mouse will explore both of them, get to know them, if you will. And then we take the mouse out, and an hour later we replace one object with a novel object, and we see how much time the mouse spends on each object. Now, the mouse that is learning, that has good short-term memory, will spend more time on the novel object, and you can see that here, as opposed to the one on the right, which is spending the same amount of time with both objects. And what did we find? Well, we found that our control mice, our normal mice, spent 75% of their time with a novel object. But look at what our TV viewing, our overstimulated mice, did. They spent the exact same amount of time. It was as if they couldn't distinguish the two objects or they didn't care. But one way or another, they were not learning. They were not acting like normal mice. Now, I want to talk a little bit about a study we did with children. It's a building block study. It was a randomized trial here in a low-income clinic in Seattle. We took 200 children who were 18 to 24 months of age, And we gave half of them blocks at the beginning of the study and half of them blocks at the end. And their parents got what we call blocktivities monthly. These were ways to play with your children with blocks. Sort the blocks, stack the blocks, count the blocks. Really simple things that come naturally to a lot of parents, but what a lot of low-income parents don't do with their children regularly. And here's what happened. The children who got the blocks, 59% of them played with them on a typical day, as opposed to 13% who didn't get the blocks initially. They played for about 20 minutes a day, about 1.5 episodes a day, and about 65% of the time was with their parent. And then 6 months later, we assessed their language. And see on the right here that the kids who got the blocks late scored in the 42nd percentile, which is below average, but unfortunately not uncommon in low-income populations in Seattle and, for that matter, around the world. And the kids who got the blocks, they actually scored a 56th percentile, significantly better and slightly above average. So promoting that kind of interactive play actually promoted language development in these young children. So I want to conclude by impressing on you that early childhood is very important for children and for mice, and it's critical to their development. And we need more real-time play today and less fast-paced media, particularly for young children. It's vitally important that we have that, because if we change the beginning of the story, we change the whole story.
Thank you to Dimitri Christakis for that. I'm spotting a similarity there with his conclusions, that perhaps simple objects in the real world are the best thing, coupled with parental attention and love, that children actually don't need much in the way of digital this, that, or the other. Now, I'm grateful that my mum had the persistence to get me out of staring at screens as a youngster and get me onto my bike or my boat to get me out with fresh air and exercise. How many kids now are even allowed out of the house as I teach kids, some of whom are shepherded around by parents so concerned for their security and their safety that their welfare doesn't seem to be on the issue, or if it does, parents can't imagine healthier pursuits than eating junk food, staring at junk entertainment. I'm oversimplifying a little perhaps to make a point, but a lot of people are failing to notice the beauty, the intrinsic interest of the world around them, because they're hypnotized by screens. I hope this show doesn't fall into that category of media that distracts us from the real world. My aim is to, of course, inspire a love for the real world and real world actions. Now we shift from looking at children's brains to a less quantifiable area of their minds. I think it was John Taylor Gatto who coined the phrase dumbing down, and his research has detailed a multi-generational process of diminished expectations. Every generation who went through the schooling system is that much more twisted in their ideas about what is possible for children to achieve. I wish we had more than 15 minutes of this, but sadly that's all we have. This is John Taylor Gatto on the childishness of modern adults.
To begin to grasp the extent of the social experiment standing behind the visible structures of mass compulsion schooling, it isn't necessary to conjure up conspiracies of the classical variety, but only to look at child rearing from an engineering point of view, as animal training beyond the reach of the animal to fully comprehend, as when a falconer shrouds his bird to prevent it from obeying its nature, or when a horse racing association dictates that lead be attached to a fast horse's saddle to bring its performance in line with the rest of the pack. In both cases, bird and horse are less than they would have been, having been reduced to instruments of a different species design. With schooling, too, it shouldn't be difficult to understand that from certain perspectives, it might also be desirable to alter the behavior of human children negatively in the interests of some managerial goal. Whether a thing is good or bad depends on one's value system. We all understand that. How otherwise could we begin to understand the bald statement made by the famous dean of teacher education at Stanford in 1919, that the term of childhood had been deliberately extended for 4 years because important people wanted it that way. What could the dean, that's Elwood Coverley, have meant? He didn't bother to elaborate. You seldom get to hear the problem of modern schooling framed as a conflict between the purposes of social managers and the purposes of individuals, families, and communities, because the 23 global corporations which control most of the flow of ideas and news and information worldwide seldom find it convenient to encourage such speculation, nor do academics in general, because it's a very bad way to get tenure. But nonetheless, this is the thesis that I'll be pursuing tonight, that enormous numbers of American children have been dumbed down and made morally incomplete in the interests of a complex theory of social management, one which emerged full-blown among corporate players somewhat over a century ago. School is the principal forge for handicapping mutilations. I'm using that term as you'd use it with a horse race. You handicap it by hanging lead weights on it. School is the central mechanism of its effectiveness. The central mechanism of its effectiveness lies in its ability to extend childhood far beyond natural bounds. Extending childhood was not originally the American way, just the reverse. Back in 1839, Alexis de Tocqueville, author of Democracy in America, and if you haven't read it, read it. It will be in every library in Boston and every library in the United States. Tocqueville tried to put his finger on a fantastic difference he had discerned between American young people and the European variety. In America, he said, I'm quoting now, there is, strictly speaking, no adolescence. At the close of boyhood, the man appears, and by inference, at the close of girlhood, the woman. That early responsibility, according to Tocqueville, imparted such a great vigor to our society that other nations could not compete, and he predicted it would be progressive and the gulf would enlarge between American power and the power of other nations, which of course it has. Where Europe inhibited the range of the young and rendered them incomplete by imposing an intricate class consciousness, age consciousness, gender consciousness, whatever, America was jettisoning such handicaps to productivity, and it roared into global prominence as a result of the advantage this conferred. Tocqueville's analysis at the beginning of the 21st century has the quaint ring of something like Alice in Wonderland, doesn't it? You see him up there. American young people are unrecognizable from Tocqueville's description. Childhood here has been artificially extended well into the 20s and beyond. That picture behind me, I assumed, was a 13-year-old boy, but because I taught eighth grades for 30 years, but someone in the hall tonight said, no, I think it's 17. But whether that's a 13-year-old boy, a 14, a 15, a 16, or a 17, no one in the audience, nor myself, finds that anything out of the norm. American teenage boys are, if they're well-behaved, are goofy, daffy, they put funny things in their ears. And we all assume that this is natural, a natural stage in child development. Indeed, I heard an older woman about my age the other day say about the two major party candidates for election in this year's presidential race, I'm quoting her now, why they're both so childish. That's the main impression she got from the so-called debates. In truth, it was my impression as well, although I would have cloaked my own discomfort by using the word boyish. That chance conversation in the supermarket overheard provoked in me a temporary sensitivity to outbreaks of childishness in the world around me, and it wasn't long before others presented themselves. In USA Today, I saw a story that the Little League Baseball Organization had cooked up a series of workshops where parents would be taught how to behave at baseball games. A necessity, the article said, because the prevailing standard of parental behavior was so childish it had become dangerous. That very same evening I read that, my wife and I went to see a delightful feature movie in cartoon form called Chicken Run. It was the 9th major film in the past 3 years presented as a cartoon for adults. All this reminded me that just a few years earlier I had sublet my New York apartment to a young attorney, age 25, a graduate of Yale, who was interning for a Wall Street firm while he was awaiting certification as a lawyer. I was on my way to Spain the next day, so I deposited his check, wished him well, and was off. And on my return from Spain to the United States, I discovered that he had stopped payment on that check. I couldn't raise him by phone, so I called his father, who'd been given me as a reference, only to learn from the father that the son had found a better deal that very next day. And apparently both father and son deemed this an adequate explanation for breaching a contract. Fortunately, I knew that the young man still needed to appear before his review panel, before his law license could be final. So I told the father I would show up at that hearing with a formal complaint unless the money was forthcoming toot sweet. And when Dad realized I had his boy over a barrel, he screamed into the phone at me. He was outraged. He said I should be ashamed of myself. His son was only 25, and hadn't I ever changed my mind when I was 25? So I could go on, but that's enough, I think. Could organized schooling have anything to do with these developments in childishness? And if so, why and how? To begin to answer that question, come back with me to the first year of the 20th century, where a book was being published by a well-known writer of the day, Edward Eggleston. Some of you will know Eggleston because he had written a best-selling novel called The Hoosier Schoolmaster. But in this book of 1901, Eggleston had set himself the task of explaining America's unusual superiority to Europe, even though most of us derived from Europe. According to Eggleston, this hadn't happened all at once. In fact, the first generations here, he said, were much like those back in Europe, crippled by habits of dependency and hierarchy, by excessive management. But gradually, the hand of custom relaxed here, and the young began to come to consciousness in a world where anything was possible. Freed from the social systems of Europe, America's young eagerly seized opportunities to learn everything and to dare everything. At the age of 7, Eggleston said, Americans put away childish things to carry their share of the load. They begin to grow up. In Europe, on the other hand, ordinary children weren't allowed decision-making responsibilities because the economies of Europe could not tolerate the kind of mind and character which emerges from early mental independence. Individuals there had to be proletarianized into masses for the benefit of factories, factory farms, standing armies, and social class stability. Whatever the particular truth of these contentions, you see that for both de Tocqueville in 1839 and Eggleston in 1900, both were agreeing that childhood in the United States was a short-lived phenomenon and that this was a good thing. A century later, it's still possible to find data to make us suspect that the earlier way has much still to recommend it, on a personal basis at least. Studies of very successful adults almost uniformly show that to a striking degree, such people grow up quickly, taking important responsibility at an early age. And history provides evidence that at one time, not so long ago, it was in fact the social norm in the United States. In 1859, for instance, Abe Lincoln told the Wisconsin Agricultural Association that the overwhelming majority of Americans, poor as well as rich, had independent livelihoods. They didn't work for anybody. That's the real American dream. Because these people had been reared from early childhood to be self-reliant, ambitious, and resourceful, and no ponderous social order, such as in Britain or Germany, had stood in their way. Just as an aside, the old order Amish in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Ohio and Indiana, in fact, raise all of their children to have independent livelihoods, and they succeed in about 99% of the instances. I'm not citing my imagination or observation, but a recent book from Johns Hopkins about the Amish. This principle of early self-reliance and adventure leading to future entrepreneurial triumph is still present with us, but it's no longer celebrated in schools. Take, for example, the case of Richard Branson, the founder of a prosperous airline and many, many other thriving businesses in various fields. One day when Branson was 7 years old, he was out with his mother on a drive miles from home when she suddenly asked him if he thought he could find his way home from there all alone. Branson said he thought he could, whereupon his mother stopped the car. "Well, get out then," she said. "Let's see if you're right," and drove off without her little boy. Is there anyone in earshot of these words who has done something similar? Not if you had an A average in school, I'm certain. Whatever your opinion of Mrs. Branson's decision, Richard himself looks back on it later in life as the foundation of his unlimited confidence in himself, which has made him a millionaire several hundred times over. Branson's curriculum aims squarely at the face of the principal myth of modern management, that most people cannot be trusted with responsibility because they are childish and incompetent. They have to be closely watched and managed. The minute Branson exited that car and set out to discover himself, he walked away from childhood.
Well, let me just assume the role of Richard Branson's mother and toss out the question, if money collapsed and was accepted nowhere, could you survive? I think that that's the question that humanity is going to have to face, because I think it will become useless. And that's one of the main reasons why almost all the forecasting based on massification, based on numbers, and especially based on the money system, seems to me that it doesn't amount to a hill of beans. Now, possibly you accept the point that at some stage money will become worthless, but either you hope or you strongly suspect that it wouldn't be in your lifetime. Well, exactly when it becomes worthless is a moot point for me. The aim is to become independent of that system and operate in the gift economy. We conclude the show with a slightly abbreviated audio version of The War on Kids. I haven't given subtitles to all the speakers, in part because I think it's illustrative to listen to them and try to puzzle out their motivations for saying what they say. I will make the film available for download, as usual, from this episode's webpage, unwelcomeguest.net/632.
And so, the very evil children took the dog out to play in the park. Then they took him home and refused to set him on fire. They were evil, evil, evil children. And they refused to do as they were told. They would say, "Why should we leave the elderly woman in the middle of the expressway? F*** you, we're not doing it." Then they would go downstairs and prepare the Molotov cocktails, knowing full well that when they were finished, there was no way in hell they were going to blow up the neighbor's barn. They were evil, evil, evil children. All their lives, people expected them to do bad, They almost never delivered.
These are America's future citizens, the boys and girls to whom we must look for leadership in our post-war democracy. These are America's hope for the future.
Zero tolerance started off as something with related to the drug war. It actually started related to the drug war and this need to make sure that guns were not coming into schools. And our country started moving to clamp down on children. And there was this fear of children. And there were some sociologists that came up with the term super predators. And the super predator generation needed to be controlled. They needed to be treated like criminals before they actually became criminals. So as a result of that, zero tolerance started off as weapons. It actually started off as firearms, then became weapons. So that meant the butter knife in school. Then after the butter knife, it became violence. And violence means varying things depending on the school district. After that, it became really discretionary, subjective things.
Twirling Tweety reflects Ashley Smith's love of the Looney Tune character. But that love got her into hot water at school when she brought a Tweety Bird keychain to class. Garrett Middle School in Cobb County has a zero tolerance policy when it comes to chains.
You know, when I was a kid, they would send you to the principal if you did something wrong, and the principal would do something to you. Maybe make you stay after school, or maybe he'd suspend you for a couple of days. These days, it doesn't seem like principals have discretion anymore. They're just made to follow a formula. If you have a gun on campus, you're expelled for the rest of the year or for the rest of your life or something. And that makes sense if you actually have a gun on campus. But what they're calling weapons are things like a little cuticle remover on a keychain or a nail clipper or a little key fob that's in the shape of a gun. They're calling this a weapon. And because it's a weapon, you're expelled.
I mean, there's a story about a 10-year-old, I think in Florida, who, around the zero-tolerance policies, stole $2 from one of his classmates. And he was charged with a felony. He was put in jail for 2 weeks. And eventually he was tried for, in addition, armed assault. I mean, this is like a 10-year-old, you know. And I think that when it comes to children's rights, you begin to get a sense of the utter institutional vengeance, the way in which a kind of hatred and vengeance towards youth has materialized in the most unfortunate ways. It's actually now legislated into laws designed to punish youth for infractions that are actually trivial.
Also, schools are referring students directly to the police. They're adding, you know, enforcement officers on their campuses who are intervening instead of principals and arresting kids and taking them away for often minor kinds of violations. What was once a minor pushing and shoving match, now it's an assault, possibly a felony assault. So over and over and over, these layers are mounting up, and we're seeing far more students winding up in our juvenile justice systems. And plus, remember, if you're guilty of a felony in many states, you lose the right to vote. So on and on, these policies of harsh discipline are contributing not only to the incarceration of youth, but their removal from being active participants in our democracy. So our democratic values are really what are at stake here.
It wasn't bad grades or bad behavior, but a bag of candy that landed this 8th grade honors student in some pretty hot water.
You heard right. Her 8-year-old son, Christopher, was suspended for playing with his chicken strip at lunch because the school says he was acting as if it was a gun and pretended to shoot a teacher.
I don't think a chicken strip is a reason to suspend a child.
A stick figure shooting a gun. New Jersey School says this violates a zero-tolerance policy on guns.
You see, the district now says Austin held the tiny G.I. Joe gun up to another student's head and threatened to shoot him. A couple of days later, Austin was suspended.
School officials say the fifth grader was brown bagging it and brought a piece of steak for her lunch. But she also brought a steak knife to cut it. That's when deputies were called.
School officials say that sniffing a magic mark or something like this could lead to negative drug behavior, and they say that's what led them to the suspension.
Well, we've handled hundreds of cases, and just some of our cases, which we a child gargles scope after lunch, a fourth grader, and the child is suspended for several days for violating a zero tolerance policy against drugs. And all it was scope. Midol, girls having Midol in their purse, and students having Alka-Seltzer. A child draws a gun at school and just joking around, showing another student he's suspended from school. A young girl, very good student, passes a nail file across the aisle to another student who wants to clean her fingernails. She's thrown out of school for a year and 3 months. Four boys on the playground are playing cops and robbers, kindergartners. They're thrown out of school for violating a zero tolerance weapons policy, and they're playing with their fingers. A young fourth grader, this is a case we had, who threatened to shoot a girl across the room with a spit wad, and he was suspended from school for violating zero tolerance policy against weapons. A spit wad, but the interesting thing in that case is that that night the police actually came by and visited the family. And they actually, the police knocked on the door and said they were investigating the shooting. This is with a spit wad.
If you look at the baby boom ideal, the older generation ideal, as it's now being expressed, it is we should have the younger generation should especially in public institutions, should all be dressed alike. They should all conform all the time to rules because, you know, zero tolerance means that we'll kick them out if they don't. Ideally, they should be out of sight all the time.
We look at it, going to school is these kids' jobs, and you need to get used to it right now. We tell them all the time, if you went dressed like that to a job, you wouldn't have a prayer. Kids just need to understand, we just need to put values back in society, and, you know, I think it'll solve a lot of the problems.
We have to have this constant monitoring and supervision system to ensure that there's never any bad behavior whatsoever. I mean, we will not tolerate the idea of, and again, this is our ideal, the thing that we're trying to achieve, of a teenager ever having a single drop of alcohol, ever trying a cigarette, ever having any kind of drugs, ever having any kind of sex, all these things, zero tolerance. I'm not sure what age we think they should be doing these things. We certainly tolerate a lot of this behavior in ourselves, but it's this idea of absolutist conformity, 100% of the time, to rules, to arbitrary rules that are one size fits all, one kind of behavior, one kind of dress, one kind of abstinence from everything. I mean, that really is basically our definition of adolescence today, is abstain from everything always.
And then you see these rules that are now being enacted, where certain infractions that in the past you would have sent the kid to the guidance teacher, and it would have been, you know, dealt with in many ways, in a kind of obvious way, you know. You slap a kid in the wrist, don't do it again, we'll call your parents. Now kids are being put in police cars, handcuffed and dragged out of school, photographed, fingerprinted.
Well, I know as a parent, I would always like to see the school system err on the side of caution. You know, these are not things that cannot be worked out afterwards. I mean, we all, under the 14th Amendment, have the right to due process. We don't squelch those rights in the school system. Students still have the right to due process.
When a child gets brought into the principal's office, let's say you got into a fight. So what happens is the principal asks the questions, the principal asks the student to write up a statement, and the principal then hands that off to the police officer, and the police officer then hands it over to the court, and the statement gets used against the child.
Tell us who was with you, just exactly what happened. You'll get off much easier.
You know, is there in a school environment, wants to be helpful to the principal, you know, wants to get rid of the situation, and, you know, opens up to the principal. You're supposed to trust your principal, right? Open up to the principal, and then the principal hands over the statement to the police. So you're right to Miranda warning. Even though the principal knows that he's going to turn you over to the police, you don't have any Miranda rights.
Because the kid's 14, they have no rights, no nothing. And they're sitting in the office getting lectured by a police officer because of something they might be thinking. Something that would be intolerable for an adult, theoretically, for an adult to tolerate, getting questioned by the police. Our kids get questioned all the time. You know, they don't get a lawyer. They don't get a warning. Parents don't get called. Say, can we question your kids? And they just get pulled in and questioned.
In Virginia, a 13-year-old, he had a friend who was suicidal, a female. He took a knife that she brought to school. He thought she was going to kill herself with it. He put it in his locker. He went and told the school officials. They sent him by himself to get the knife. They didn't think he was a threat. He brought the knife back, and they threw him out of school for a half a year for violating a weapons policy of the school, zero tolerance. The school board in that case commended him for what he did, but they still suspended him. Now, see, that's why they end up in court, and the only way that you can get redress is in a courtroom. There is absolutely no other way because the schools don't listen. The parents that we defend, the students we defend, they've gone to the parent, they've gone to the principal, they've gone to the teachers, and they can't get a remedy.
That kind of unyielding authoritarian approach is alienating students not only from their schools, but also, I think, from the concept of being part of a democracy. They are not getting the message that being part of society is something that includes them, that respects them. And so that sort of disrespect of their voice, their concerns, their interests gets translated in the school discipline policies.
The great casualty of all this stuff, from zero tolerance to the war on drugs or whatever you want to call it, what we see happening is that everything that great Americans have fought for the last 200 plus years in terms of our freedoms is going to be lost.
There's really no research to support zero tolerance policies. Nothing that shows it makes anybody safer. There's no research to show that kids are benefiting. Or that, in fact, just the opposite when it comes to achievement. There's new data from Ruskiba at the Indiana Policy Institute showing that there's a high correlation between low achievement and the high use of suspension.
I know a lot of my friends that cry themselves to sleep from this, that wish they were dead. And it's appalling. Like, it'll make you sick to your stomach to know everything that's going on, know the experiences that people have gone through in here. And these are supposed to be people that you trust and that are supposed to be there to help you. And they're just trying to get rid of you.
What we've turned the schools into is basically extensions of the police force, and they're not really schools anymore. They're starting to resemble more and more like prison-like complexes where you have police walking the halls these days, and dogs and drug-sniffing dogs walking the hallways.
What's the lesson here? The lesson is that the most cherished institution that we have, or we have had in the past, one that speaks in the most direct way to how a society wants to invest in the future by virtue of how it feels about youth, now all of a sudden models a prison.
This is our main entry building. We have the main control center that processes everyone through the institution. They're in charge of all the doors, cameras, everything that happens in the facility goes through the control center. This is the entry officer with the entry desk here. Everyone that comes to the institution has to process through this entry desk. So I'll go ahead and process through. We have the buckets here for the personal property, so we just take everything off. All jewelry has to come off. Everything out of all pockets has to come out so the officer can check all the property. Once you have everything out, then you go step through the metal detector. If it goes off like that and you don't pass, then you have to make sure your pockets are removed.
This is a wonderful security force. They do a great job of making sure that we're safe in the building. Again, everyone that comes in has to check in with them, and then they tell them which part of the building to go through. We do have a metal detector to ensure safety. Every student that enters the building comes in through a metal detector in various points of the building, but there's no other way to get in unless you pass through. So it's a little tedious, but once the kids get used to it, the line moves a little bit quicker.
One of the things also we have here, anytime you have a door, the secured Sallyport door, we have a camera focused on that door. That way, whenever staff want to access into the area, the control center officers can look in the camera and see exactly who's there. So we know exactly who's going in and out of doors. And we're not just letting anyone access any part of the institution at any time. So that's one of the very important security features we have here is our camera system. And it's utilized very often on a day-to-day basis.
We have security cameras through, I would say, 90% of the building. There's some areas that aren't covered by the cameras, but we try to make sure we know what's going on in the building, especially in the hallways. Again, if we see kids in the hallway that they're not, in an area they're not supposed to be, the department chairpersons and the vice principals and security come quickly.
This is our library. We have a full-time librarian that's here. We also have a full law library in back. The law library is for the inmates to use to check on case law or administrative regulations so they know exactly what the rules and regulations are. The inmate can use the book and then he returns it to the law library.
I'm going to go around to the library now.
No, it's locked on the inside.
Very nice sized library. I mean, I don't know. Do you need to go in here or?
One of the other things we do here is let the inmates express themselves, and we have some inmates that are very good painters, so they've done murals like you see here on the wall. They also paint throughout the institution year round, so all the walls are freshly painted.
Will they put this on? Ceiling tiles. Now again, it's I don't know what the design pattern was, but the tiles, what happens is there's a lot of piping and stuff in there. And when there's a leak or something, the water pools up there, some of the tiles fall. They used to have a net that was going up and across.
This is one of our general classrooms. This classroom here is used for reading and teaching reading skills, writing, grammar, English. And as you can see, it's set up just like a normal classroom. So we actually employ teachers to come in and teach.
This is a locker room for some of the sports teams also. I think the soccer team is there, depending on the season. If it's soccer season, the soccer team has it. If it's baseball, then the baseball team has out in there. But this is probably one of the larger classrooms. There may be one or two that are bigger.
Correct. Mr. Stevie Campos, if you're in the building, please call security or stop by security desk. Mr. Campos, if you're in the building, please call 4949 or stop by the security desk. Thank you.
All right, this is part of the business department. You know, it's the old model. We have trouble in the lunchroom, so we don't have lunch anymore. That doesn't kind of make sense. You know, you got to find out why you're having trouble, what you have to do to make it better. How do you get the kids and teachers to participate? How do you get families to support it? I'm not telling you it's easy, but I would rather retire, which I can do at my age, than work in a school that was modeled after being a prison.
Ain't that everyone associates Columbine with the worst school shooting ever? Everything that has to do with schools associated with people got shot here.
That's another thing. I don't think we should have to get in trouble for what we wear. It's a statement of what we like, what we believe in. Why should you get in trouble for that? It makes no sense.
I got a little bit mad when they said you couldn't come inside I was like, why can't they come inside? There's cameras all over the school anyway.
I think there's like 37 cameras.
total?
That they admit him.
Yeah.
Oh my God, the gym. You walk out and there's a camera here looking at you. So like, you turn around and there's a camera looking at you that way. And it freaks me out. Doesn't that creep you out? No, dude, they're worthless. My friend Sam got her purse stolen and they reviewed the tape and they didn't know who did it.
It's because the camera spin and it just made to put fear in the lives of teenage kids.
I really believe that most of our students feel safer with resource officers there. They feel safer with the monitors, knowing that if some irrational person walks off the street with the intent to do bodily harm to them or their friends, that there's probably someone watching a monitor that can see it much quicker and prevent that thing from happening, or at least slowing it down to where you don't have another Columbine situation. You can't guarantee that monitors will do that, but I think that they feel safer by having them there because they aren't involved in any illegal activity, and they don't worry about monitors watching. They feel safer with that.
It's kind of creepy. So everyone's like, yep, we're in jail. All right. You just sit here and do my work. Everyone's worried that if you do anything that looks remotely like a drug deal or something, that you're going to get in a lot of trouble. So everybody's like staying like as far away from cameras as they possibly can. And I don't even look up in the hallways. I'm like, because I don't like knowing, it's kind of weird knowing that people can just like watch you walk around the halls. You're like, okay. It's kind of, it's really creepy actually. It's because it's like someone watching you in your house because you're there so often. They don't really prevent anything. They just take pictures of it. You know, they just show what happened. They can't really prevent anything at all.
You know, the cameras started out being in the hallways, you know, for your safety, in case there's a fight, then we can know, or whatever. Now they're outside, you know, now they're on the buses, they're everywhere. You know, you can't hide. And I remember I used to read about prisoners of war and stuff, people that would go through, that would be captured by the North Vietnamese or whatever. And, you know, the physical torture was awful, the deprivation, the loneliness. But the thing that, the theme that kind of ran through what was so awful about being a prisoner was never knowing when you're going to be observed. So it drove them crazy. And I think never knowing when that little in the door is going to open up and someone's going to watch you and shut it. And that's what it's like for our kids.
The kids want to be safe. And it's really made a difference. You know, we made a decision early on that we're going to make a decision for the kids that really want to learn and want to do the right thing. And if you don't want to be in that group, then, you know, you may have some problems. But we haven't had any opposition whatsoever. Now, we spent a lot of money on cameras just for security, you know, that we can, anything goes on or we see any car pull up, anything, we got ways to monitor that at all the times. And we got tilt and zoom where we can get your license plate or, I mean, we can get anything. We can pull it right up and see what color your eyes are all over our campus, which is great.
Most of the places that I used to go to, the opening question that parents would have or teachers would be related to safety. It was peculiar to me because in the work that I was doing, I was looking at curriculum and instruction. Nobody asked me about content, curriculum, instruction. They asked me, will my kid be safe? Is it easy to get to? So I think that's a terrible stain on America. We should have a country where people are worried about being safe in schools. There's something wrong with that.
Some of the studies indicate probably 70% of the parents are afraid of another Columbine incident. And you look at the vulnerability that we have, certainly. Look at the vulnerability of City Hall. We don't have metal detectors. We don't have security checking everybody that comes in. We're certainly vulnerable. But how much and how far do you go to prepare?